yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a-screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to talk about the global picture, and particularly, well, I guess it's a combination of economics and politics and military and so forth. The topic is the U.S. empire. Well, when we talk about empire, we talk about a number of dimensions of the same. For example, economic empire, political empire, military empire, cultural empire. Okay, is the end of the U.S. empire begun? Or is the empire getting stronger? Or are both happening at the same time? Well, we got to define our terms a little bit, which I'm going to do, but first let me introduce my guests. My guests are Kevin Zeese and Margaret Flowers. Both are hosts of Clearing the Fog Radio, and my colleagues on the Green Shadow Cabinet. Kevin, I believe, is Attorney General Shadow, and Margaret is Health Secretary Shadow. They are also longtime Washington, D.C. area activists, Occupy movements in the past, and directly involved in resistance.org, and are chroniclers of the grassroots resistance. I guess that's a good way of putting it, chroniclers of what's going on today. Very important to know what's going on today, because it doesn't, of course, get much, if any, coverage in the media as we know it, which is now controlled more than ever before. 30 years ago, there used to be more than 50 different media organizations, corporations, of course, but still. Today, the mass media is controlled by six big multi-corporations. So you're not going to get anything except the big business corporate capitalist viewpoint. It's hard to know what's going on out there, isn't it, unless it's just local. Well, both Kevin and Margaret are very much involved in trying to chronicle and report on what's going on, and we'll have them discuss that a little bit, particularly in relationship to resistance to the empire. Right. Well, what's an empire? Let me say a few things before we turn to our guests and have them discuss the topic, and they've written something very recently on it, which they'll refer you to. Go take a look at it. It's on the alternate blog. But what is empire? Let me provide some background. You know, prior to recent decades, since World War II, of course, empire meant military conquest, political occupation, and strip out the wealth of whoever it was you conquered. In the old Roman times, you just grabbed all the gold that they had, and then you enslaved the people directly, and you brought them back and put them on your big farms and made them produce and just barely keep them alive. Slave labor, right? And that's where most of the wealth was created, by extracting slave labor. And then, of course, things got a little bit more sophisticated. You know, in Europe, colonial governments, the British Empire, of course, 18th, 19th century, ran on colonial government model, where you conquered the people, and then you brought in your corporations, your capitalist organizations, and then those capitalist organizations hired people, because it was cheaper to hire than to keep them as slaves, you extracted the wealth from those prices, either natural resources, spices, and so forth, or you got people there to work and make your textiles ship it back to good old England, and then resell it at a nice margin and make your profits that way. So That's how empires evolved. And then, of course, we have the U.S. empire, which we have a totally new model for here. You know, capitalism does not stand still. It changes its strategy, it changes its organization, and even its tactics, and it's very flexible and very clever. So after 1945, what do we get? Okay, well, we get, people aren't aware, most of what was set up after 1945 is to help the U.S. multinational corporations pillage the world. And they went out after 1945, the rest of the world was economically on its knees, and expanded throughout the globe. Exports and foreign direct investment, and taking over companies in the conquered lands and so forth, joining with local capitalists to profit from expanding local markets, and free trade, which is designed to move offshore, produce more cheaply, and send the stuff back to the mainland to be sold, and make a big profit that way. And then raw materials extraction to some extent, oil, minerals, cheap, right? And at first just run by multinationals, and then they bring in the local capitalists, and they have a nice scratch-your-back-scratch-my-back arrangement. Everyone gets rich if you're a capitalist. Okay, so multinational corporations are at the heart, not government agencies, of modern economic empires. And to enable this general process, U.S. dominated global economic institutions were created to smooth the process, make sure it works. Institutions like the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank. Well, what's their role? Well, their role is, since it's a market economy, to make sure that the U.S. currency is dominant as a reserve currency, as a trading currency, and when things get out of whack in these colonies, what they do is make sure they bail out, but at terms that keep them even more tightly integrated with the global empire. World Bank, well, you fund projects built by U.S. multinationals that make all the profits, that create the infrastructure in these colonies, economic colonies, that enable even more profit extraction. And then, of course, we have the central banks, like the U.S. Federal Reserve, and the other central banks that pretty much follow whatever the U.S. Federal Reserve central bank wants to do. We see this happening, of course, in the U.K. and Europe and Japan, their own central banks. And then there's the BIS, Bank of International Settlements, the Central Bank of Central Banks. Global banking, shadow banking. U.S. penetrates the world here, particularly the new shadow banking, which is dominantly a U.S.-U.K. Institutional change in the last 20, 30 years. And then there's institutions, economic institutions like the G7, where the U.S. coordinates with its finance minister friends elsewhere among the leading Western economic capitalist countries, the World Economic Forum, where they get together and decide what they need to do long term, free trade deals like Trans-Pacific Partnership and the TTIP in Europe coming that follow NAFTA-CAFTA bilateral agreements. So there's a big economic institutional structure here that overlays the multinational corporations pillaging of the world, and then to back up these institutions and pillaging, we have a web of U.S. military bases. Now, this appears to be the empire much more clearly because they're much more obvious. You know, we got NATO. We got 110 military bases. No, excuse me. We got more than that. We got over 1,000 military bases. And, you know, U.S., when it conquers, it never leaves. You know, look at 70 years later, Japan and Germany and Italy, the opponents of U.S. capital during World War II, they are still occupied by tens of thousands of American military personnel, tens of thousands. You know, the U.S. conquers, and it never leaves. It creates NATOs and CETOs and so forth. All of these are designed to integrate the military organizations of these once competitors into the U.S. military network. And now we see surveillance security apparatuses growing everywhere, NSA, CIA, special ops, which are global SWAT teams. Militarization of the police globally, we talked about that last week under U.S. direction. Drone warfare, electronic SWAT teams, basically a domination. The question is, if you look at this militarily and economically, as well as political institutions that are dominated by the U.S., NATO, CEDAW, UN, Security Council, so forth, altogether it's the empire. Okay, so if we want to ask ourselves, is the empire growing stronger? We want to look at these institutions and these networks, economic and political, and say, well, is the U.S. growing stronger? Are these networks getting stronger? Are these institutions even more dominant by the U.S. or less dominant? Are U.S. multinational corporations and bankers even more dominant today than they were 20, 30 years ago? And then we want to ask ourselves at the same time, well, reverse the question, are these institutions and this network and these levers of economic and political power actually getting weaker? Or can both be happening at the same time in different places, one getting stronger, one getting weaker? This is the question before us. If we want to say, well, the U.S. economic or U.S. empire is getting weaker, or no, it's being challenged, or no, it's actually getting stronger. I mean, look at what's happening in Europe here with the Ukraine. The U.S. has undertaken a number of moves to slap the Europeans in line. The Europeans, of course, have big economic problems, the European Union, the Eurozone in particular, and they were willing simply to negotiate an IMF trade deal in the Ukraine favorable to itself. But the U.S. said, no, wait a minute, that's not enough. We got an opportunity here in Ukraine. Let's put our NGOs on the ground into action, financed by us, $5 billion admitted by Assistant Secretary of State Virginia Nuland. And even if they are fascists, let's use them. And, of course, they did that, and they pulled off the coup in the Ukraine. And not only are wanting to integrate the Ukraine into the U.S. economic orbit, but also politically integrate the Ukraine into the NATO military orbit. Okay, so that's an example of U.S. empire being more aggressive. Of course, we've had the empire contending with a lot of local folks throughout the Middle East, with some successes and some failures. And don't forget that Israel is part of the U.S. empire. Israel is the largest land-based aircraft carrier in the world for the U.S., and that's exactly what's going on there now. U.S. is making a greater play in Africa. It's talked about a pivot to Asia. And, of course, you know, we have a lot of other examples where the last two decades it has expanded, like in Eastern Europe, busting up Yugoslavia and so forth. Okay, so that's my say as a kind of a background here. And I want to turn now to our guests and have them comment. Is the empire getting stronger or is it getting weaker? What are the new examples of resistance to the empire? Now, both Kevin and Margaret have written about this, and I want them to begin by saying where you can go to read their views on resistance to empire. Kevin?
Yeah, well, that's quite a good summary of the history of empire and where we are. The best place to read about our views on empire is popularresistance.org. Popular Resistance is a daily news summary of what's happening in the movement for social, economic, and environmental justice. And we published both of the articles, this two-part series on empire, and it's not the first thing we've written, so when you see those two articles, the most recent one is near the top of the front page because we just published it today. When you look at that article, you'll see links at the bottom to other articles, including part one of this. As far as determining whether the empire is getting weaker or stronger, it's not an easy thing to do because empires don't like to show weakness. They want to show that they are omnipotent, that they can't be challenged, and therefore they are not going to openly show their weakness. And it's sometimes when you see an empire fading, you also see the empire getting involved in more aggressive actions to try to keep control.
Good point. Right. Let me interject here. That's a very good point. Signs of increased aggressiveness may be signs of growing weakness. Go ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, for example, the Asian pivot, which I think is a really interesting example because it's a combination of all the aspects of U.S. empire, which is military, economic, and political. You can see the military part with Obama shifting massive U.S. resources to the Asian Pacific. With 60% of the Navy there, you can see them pushing allies, Australia and New Zealand and Japan, in particular Japan, which, you know, had just ended, reinterpreted its constitution, which didn't allow it to attack other countries. Now it can attack other countries if they're still in conjunction with other nations.
Let me just interject on that one, too, Kevin, because, you know, people think, oh, this is a conflict between Japan and China over the Senkaku Islands, which are just a couple rocks,
right.
But it's not the islands, it's the oil they're all fighting about over there offshore. But Japan would not do this without the direct, and behind-the-scenes manipulation. Because Japan has no foreign policy. It's just an extension of the U.S. foreign policies. Japan
since
World War II.
Time.
Yeah, it's an economic satrapy since World War II of the United States. Go ahead.
And the people of Japan don't want U.S. military bases on their soil. But the government refuses to move them and or close them, and when they are forced to move them, they just move them to another part of Japan. So in Australia, former prime ministers talked about how the new agreements with the United States risk war for Australia with China. So you can see all these in South Korea. You can see Obama has increased dramatically the number of war games in the Asian Pacific, much bigger, much larger, much more aggressive with simulated nuclear attacks on North Korea going right up to their border with the nuclear attack planes. I mean, it's very aggressive stuff. And that's just, and to me, that's not a sign of strength. That's a sign that the United States fears China. China is being encircled militarily. It's being encircled economically with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a trade agreement for Pacific nations, including Asian nations, that does not include China. And so it's trying to weaken China economically. And, of course, politically, the U.S. uses its political power in the Asian area constantly with all these governments, as with Japan, Australia, with these new agreements that entangle them further in our military affairs. And so, China, the Asian Pacific is an example of a fear of a competitor resulting in the U.S. empire getting more aggressive and, I think, stretching itself more thinly. And that's, I think, a sign of it's a counterproductive aggressiveness that's going to actually undermine it. Of course, you can see it in Israel right now. That's, again, a war about resources. The three youth that were killed were never ordered by Hamas. That's now being admitted by top officials in Israel. A police chief admitted it yesterday, saying it was a cell that was independent of Hamas that did this. And so this was never really about those kids. It was about other issues, and there are a number of other issues. But one of the big ones is the natural gas supply off the Gaza coast, which would provide Israel with enough gas to become an exporter while at the same time serving its own energy into the next two decades. So the United States is involved in supporting that, obviously. It's allowed this. Now, by the way, today, at this moment, the number of deaths in Gaza has gotten over 1,000. So that's become a brutal. The Ukraine situation, again, another example. We're stretching thin the U.S. military, stretching thin the CIA. While all these are, and that's a fear of Russia, because Russia is a big natural gas country, and down the road it will be even more powerful because of its control of natural gas. The U.S. empire needs to break up Russia in order to control that, and Russia knows it's coming. China knows it's coming. The Middle Eastern countries know what's coming. People are into the game now. They see what's happening with this U.S. empire, and so you're starting to see them, you know, organize against Empire. I'm sure they'll want. I'd love to hear your views on the new BRICS alternative to the IMF, this new lending authority that is going to be based in Shanghai with a president from in India rotating, and Brazil will take over next. It's essentially China, Russia, Brazil, India, and South Africa joining together to create an alternative to the IMF and World Bank, and that's a massive threat to the U.S. dollar supremacy. You're already seeing bilateral agreements between Russia and China doing deals without the dollar as the intermediary. China's doing that with other countries as well. So the dollar is becoming weaker as the world currency. So there's lots of signs of weakness, but you can't underestimate the power of the empire. The U.S. is one quarter of the world economy, and our GDP is one quarter of the world GDP. Our military is half of the whole military of the world. When you combine our tightest allies like Israel, the UK, Japan, France, Sweden, you even have a greater control of domination of the empire's military through NATO and the U.S. directly, as well as the world economy. So it's a very mixed picture. But I think for the first time, Empire is beginning to be challenged. You're seeing it on the ground level with the protests in Europe. You're seeing it with the Indignado protests in Europe, the Arab Spring protests, the Occupy protests. On the ground level, people are revolting. And you see multiple reports of different banking agencies, world elite leadership, who are expressing concerns about more uprisings at the grassroots level. So I think this is an opportunity. The U.S. economy is faltering. There's no prediction it's going to really ever spiral up in any significant way in the foreseeable future. In fact, it's going to at best be level and with continuous declines along the way. So the economy that funds the empire is weakening. The U.S. military has not won a war since World War II. The currency is under attack. The grassroots is attacking empire. So I think this is an opportunity, and I think people in the United States have a special responsibility to be aware of this, educated about it, organizing and mobilizing about it. We're seeing more and more groups starting to focus not just on one war, but on multiple wars. There's two groups I'll mention. One is Come Home America, which is a right-left combination of viewpoints that oppose U.S. interventionist foreign policy. And I'll mention World Beyond War, which is an effort to try to build an international movement to oppose war. When you oppose war, you're opposing the empire, because that is the greatest cause of war in the world. That's my quick response. I'm sure Morgan has something to add to it. Yeah, well, I may have stolen all of the thunder. I don't know. I may have taken all the thunder. I'm not sure.
Just to follow up a few comments of my own on what you've said here, I recently, I would refer listeners to an article, which I'll try to have posted here on the Progressive Radio Network, published an article in Counterpunch that was called Putin, Ukraine, and the Future of Europe, pointing out that there are a number of dimensions in this Ukraine crisis, but probably the most important is the fight over Europe, the EU. The U.S., of course, has always long dominated Western Europe, but in the last decade, Western Europe, particularly Germany, Italy, and some others, have become more and more integrated with the Russian economy, particularly the energy side of the Russian economy, but also a lot of other trade and investment and so forth. And I believe the U.S. Has viewed this with some concern, this drift towards Russia economically. And the Ukraine was a good opportunity for the U.S. to jump in and stir the pot and create a crisis and hopefully try to provoke Putin to invade the Ukraine, which would then provide the excuse for the U.S. To sever the relationships that had been growing between Western Europe, particularly Germany, and the Ukraine. And, of course, it would give a big opportunity for the U.S. to supplant the natural gas exports from Russia to Western Europe, which are significant. A lot of Eastern Europe countries, 100% depend on EU countries, 100% depend on Russian natural gas, Germany and others, 30-40%. Well, this is a great opportunity for the U.S. to export its shale gas, which has a glut now in the U.S. and limits on exports. So this is a way of breaking those limits on exports in Congress and shifting that gas and allowing the U.S. banks deeper penetrate Western Europe once again, because Russian financing was flowing west as well, particularly through the UK. So, you know, you have to look at this as part of maintaining, attempts to maintain the global empire. But the fact that the U.S. felt it had to jump in and take control of the attempt to absorb the Ukraine from the Europeans, who were just simply content on negotiating an IMF trade deal, and the U.S. said, no, no, here's an opportunity to complete the Orange Revolution of 10 years ago and bring NATO into the Ukraine and strip the Ukraine out from the Russian influence totally. So that's a play, as you point out, going on globally. What's going on in the Middle East has been of limited success for the empire, as you mentioned. And I think that's part of the pivot to Asia. You know, the army and those corporations that U.S. corporations that supply military industrial complex, supply the army. They've had their wars now in the Middle East for 10 years. Now it's time to turn the contracts around and give it to the Navy and the Air Force. And that's part of what this pivot to Asia is all about. And this has happened before. You know, after the U.S. failed to really deal with Cuba back in the early 60s, it turned to Vietnam. Even Johnson, President Johnson at this time, said, look, you know, I'm not going to invade Cuba, but I got to placate my military. And he picked a fight over there with little Vietnam that didn't work either. But that was a way of redirecting the generals' attention to another opportunity. And that goes on a lot in the U.S. As far as the economy faltering, listeners should tune in next week to this show, because I'm going to talk about the second quarter, that is April-June, economic GDP results for the U.S. We've had shows here and talked about the 2.9% drop in GDP in the first quarter. By the way, whenever GDP has dropped 17 out of 18 times more than 2.5%, it's resulted in a recession. 17 out of 18 times, that kind of a GDP drop eventually led to a recession. So we want to really look at what's happened here with the preliminary numbers for GDP, the second quarter coming out next week, and our show next week will talk about that. As folks know, for 2 years now, I've been predicting a recession in 2014-15 in the U.S. So that's just an aside here. But Margaret, I'd like you to jump in and express your views on this global empire. Is it getting stronger? Is it getting weaker? What's the resistance?
Sure. Thank you for having me on, Jack. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Perfect.
Great. Great. So I think that, you know, I wanted to comment on one of the things you mentioned about the United States kind of becoming the space for supplying fracked gas, fracked methane gas, and other methods of extreme energy extraction. Like, we see the first U.S. tar sands pit is beginning to be mined in Utah, if we don't stop that. And these trade agreements that are actually, particularly the one with the EU, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, is geared towards making the United States Europe's kind of sacrifice zone, so that we'll destroy our environment, our public health, to provide them with energy. And it's great for the oil and gas companies. It's not good for us. So I just think that listeners really need to be aware of that and join the mobilizations to stop this extreme energy extraction. But I think overall, and I'm not the only one, I mean, it's being predicted, and you can see it if you look around, that the United States empire is coming to an end. Alfred McCoy, as we write, predicts that by 2025 will be significantly weaker. So what that means for us in the United States is, how are we going to respond to this decline in you know, this overreach of our military and what that does to our economy, our failure of our political system to be able to respond in a meaningful way to address the multiple crises that we're facing. So, you know, now is absolutely the time to mobilize. Unfortunately, we do see more and more people mobilizing in the United States and around the world, where it's time for us to kind of redefine, to see the opportunity in these crises to redefine what we would like to have going on instead, and how do we create those systems that would be designed to create the ends that we want, to create more equality in our societies, to create more sustainability, to lift us up and have a more of a participatory democracy system. When we were organizing the Occupation of Freedom Plaza back in 2011, we wrote an open letter to the international community because we understood that our struggles here in the United States are really linked to the struggles around the world, that the United States empire is driving much of the decline globally. And so for other people's revolutions or you know, resistance efforts to succeed, we really have to build a broad-based resistance effort here in the United States. And so uniting our struggles, seeing that our different work through various areas, whether you're talking about trying to improve or change the healthcare system to one that really works, whether you're fighting for quality public education or housing for everyone or to change the economy, all of this work is connected to the broader struggle for social, economic, and environmental justice. And it's important that we recognize that and start to really connect our struggles to stop these harmful policies like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and other trade agreements, to stop this attack on internet freedom, which will really undermine our efforts to get information and to organize and to start creating these alternative democratic structures that produce desirable results.
Well, that's an extremely good point. All of these different events, what we're suggesting here, are connected. As you've pointed out, what's going on globally is connected to the U.S. economy, obviously, and the fact that we haven't had any real recovery for most folks here, and the further deterioration of the environment, and et cetera. It's unfortunate that Americans tend to look at these as single, separate issues. I've talked and railed about this on this show many times, that the single-issue politics thing is the bane of resistance. And as long as we approach these things in sort of separate entities, these crises and these problems and these attacks and so forth, we don't understand the big picture. And until we understand the big picture, we don't understand that we're really all fighting the same fight, just on different fronts. But we better get together and do it in a united fashion, because we are all fragmented, pursuing single-issue politics, this and that, and we need to get together. Because that fragmentation, you know, divide and conquer, is sort of a self-destruction, as I see it. And at some point, we need to, American resistance needs to understand it's all related, and get together and form a united movement and organization, even, at some point, to deal with it more effectively. Anyway, that's my point once again on that topic. We need to take a little break here, but I want you both to think about, when we come back and comment on, when we do, what is this empire doing? What does it mean as it becomes more desperate, as it becomes more aggressive? What does this mean for democracy in America? How is this translating into an attack on democratic rights that have been the heritage of this country, in limited sense, but important nonetheless, for a long time? How is this a direct attack on democratic rights in America? Okay, we're going to take a quick break and come back and address that. First with Kevin, then Margaret as well. This is Alternative Visions, your host Jack Rasmus, and we're going to take a quick break and be right back. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions, and my guests are
Kevin Zeese, Margaret Flowers. The topic of discussion is the American empire. Is it getting stronger or is it getting weaker or both? Evidence of both developments are traceable, which means it is moving into a period of instability and flux. Here are both examples of stronger resistance, both popular from the ground up and from other countries as well. We have the struggle going on in Ukraine, which is one strong flashpoint. We have it going on in offshore in China, where resistance plays are going on from both sides here. And on the economic front, I think Kevin had asked me to comment on the BRIC bank. BRICS, of course, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, this alternative bloc that's been formed globally here, have recently decided to form their own World Bank in opposition to the U.S.-dominated World Bank that's been in effect since 1944. Again, the World Bank is a U.S.-controlled and it and its allies-funded investment bank, public bank, that invests in infrastructures in the developing world as a way of tying those economies closer to the West, and the U.S. in particular, and providing money for Western construction companies to go in there and build these things and then run them. And now you have a stranglehold because you on the economies of those countries and political means of whipping the local elite in place, in line, if they attempt to resist. And, of course, the IMF does the same thing with money, loaning money to these countries when they need it, and that ties them even more closely to the Western economies. And the fight going on today, for example, in Argentina is a good example of resistance by a developing country, Argentina, to this monetary control by the IMF and the World Bank, well, IMF in the case of Argentina here. Many examples of movement here, but the BRICS, the BRIC Bank. Well, I see this as just an early initiative. The BRIC Bank itself is not, excuse me, a real threat to the West and the U.S. yet. Yes, it is funded by these different countries, and it is envisioned as an alternative investment vehicle, mostly China. Most of the money is coming from China. So it has the potential, but even more threatening is the possibility that the Chinese currency, the yuan, or renminbi, may become more of a international currency exchange used by other countries, so they don't have to borrow dollars, which ties them into the U.S. economic empire, in order to trade with each other. A bilateral trade where they're trading just based on their own currencies, like China and Brazil, is also another such development. The BRICS are an example of a challenge, and the BRIC Bank may become more of that challenge, but we'll see. The formation of the G20 nations as a counterweight to the G7, which is Western Europe, Japan, and U.S., is another example that's been going on in the last 10 years as well. We have a number of examples of economic challenge, but just really beginning. It's not at a point where it's really, I think, a real threat yet. But certainly, it represents a change in a direction that can become a threat. Changing the currency, dominant currency, or competing dominant currency in these global institutions. When you see these global economic and political alternative institutions forming, that's a sign of weakness in the empire. And we'll see how they deal with that, of course. But let's turn back to the question that I threw out here before our break here. as the economic and U.S. general military empire grows stronger and stronger, appeals to, or grows more aggressive. I guess we should distinguish between strength and aggressiveness, because aggressiveness may be a reflection of declining strength. But as we said, as Margaret said, this has big impacts on us domestically here in the U.S. How is this empire, as it gets more aggressive globally and more violent globally since the collapse of the Soviet Union, it's really unfettered, and I would say not just the collapse of the Soviet Union has really released it to more aggressive initiatives, but I would say the collapse of any kind of organized domestic U.S. opposition. You know, the collapse of the Soviet Union, corresponding to that, has been the collapse of the labor movement in the United States. As any kind of alternative pole, resistance to the domestic economic effects of empire. And as we see with the collapse of unions in the United States and labor in the United States, you know, the empire is running roughshod over its own people, just as it is running roughshod over people around the world. So domestic impacts of this are just as important. Kevin, what can you add to? I mean, how is this empire being reflected in the decline and attack on democratic rights in the U.S.?
Well, that's a great question. There's a lot of that going on. Just quickly on BRICS and the G20, there are also other institutions forming alternatives to the OAS, which is U.S. dominated. You're seeing an alternative developing in Latin America. You're seeing alternatives to U.S. dominated institutions in Asia also forming, as well as the Middle East. And so these are all in their early stages, but they are foundations, and they can be quickly built upon. And so
Good point. The
U.S. Yes. Empire needs to be worried about these foundations being put in place, because they can grow quickly, especially as U.S. abuse becomes more evident. As far as democracy in the United States, well, first off, we have to start draw a line of where we're starting. We are a very feeble democracy. We like to tell ourselves we're the greatest democracy on earth, but that's an absolute falsehood. We are a manipulated democracy. Some call it some theorists, political scientists call it a managed democracy, where the people are managed and allowed to vote, but managed in that they can only vote for two candidates, both of which support Wall Street, the military-industrial complex, the insurance industry, all the big business interests dominate both parties. And so we really aren't given a choice. It's almost like the mullahs in Iran get to choose who the people of Iran get to vote for. They're all approved by the mullahs, and here they're all approved by Wall Street and other big business interests. So we have a corporate-dominated election system.
Wall Street, economic mullahs. I like that metaphor, economic mullahs.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
So it's a kind of a fraudulent democracy to begin with, as far as the electoral part goes. And then we've also seen over the years our political rights, the First Amendment, right to assemble, right to speech, right to petition the government for our grievances. All these rights are also being weakened. You know, you mentioned the labor unions have gone downhill. That's been going on really since the end of World War II. The Taft-Hartley started that process, and it's just continued ever since. But what we're seeing now that's different is I think we're seeing one of the biggest mass uprisings in labor than we've seen in decades. Over the minimum wage issue, the fight for 15 and the and increasing wages so people can have a living wage. This is a mass effort, and it's not just unions doing it. It's non-union workers doing it. It's communities joining in. You're seeing for the first time links between communities and unions fighting about public schools, for example, with the teachers' unions, and more radical teachers' unions getting put in power, not just in Chicago, which kind of led the effort, but in Boston and Los Angeles. And so you're seeing a different kind of resurgence there. So while the unions are weaker, you're also seeing this kind of activity grow. I mean, of course, the big problem with the big unions is they're tied to the Democratic Party, and they're starting to see some breaks there, too. They're small at this point, but you're seeing at the local level, there's a whole Ohio slate of candidates that were elected challenging Democrats. And so you're seeing more and more talk of breaking from the Democratic Party, particularly at the local level, but even rhetorically at the top levels of unions. And so if that begins to happen, that is a massive change. And again, you're seeing at the early stages still, but you're seeing that develop. And so, yes, political rights are being weakened. We're seeing laws put in place that give the government more power to undermine the protests because they fear protests. Again, it's the same kind of yin-yang where, yes, you're seeing efforts like the mass dragnet surveillance and the funding bills for DOD providing all sorts of tools for crackdowns, but you're also seeing that happen because of the resurgence in protests. And you see constant talk about fear of protests from corporate think tanks and corporate advisors to government advisors. The military is spending tons of money now on studying how movements develop, and they've spent tens of millions of dollars in research money to study movements, how they develop, how they catch fire, how they become essentially, like a flu virus, going around the country. They're very worried about this. And so, again, it's that hard to tell. Yes, things are weakening on the law front, but things are growing on the resistance front. We sometimes can't keep up with the amount of resistance happening. We try to report on it on popularresistance.org. And people should sign up for our daily digest, by the way, if you want to really keep on top quickly on what's going on in resistance movements. Sign up for our daily digest. You'll get an email in the morning that will summarize 15 to 20 stories in one paragraph each with a photo, and you can go to more details on those stories. But it will show you there is a movement.
They can sign up by going to resistance.org.
Popularresistance.org.
Popularresistance.org. Okay, everyone heard that. Go ahead.
And so make sure you sign up for that. And, there's also more and more people in the academic community who are seeing the United States for what it really is, and that's an oligarchy really ruled by the wealthy. And there's been multiple research studies done by academics in this year that have shown from different angles how the people have no voice, that the oligarchs rule. And this involves big studies of political action in the legislatures and who is in the legislatures, and it's basically showing that we are, a plutocracy, and that's who is in control. So, yes, there are attacks on democracy, but there's also a democratic uprising. We've started a campaign called Rolling Rebellion for Real Democracy, rollingrebellion.org, which just had its first series of events just after, around July 4th and a week after, where there are protests in different parts of the country. And that's going to be an ongoing campaign that's going to continue to build, because all over we hear people talking about the need for a real democracy in the United States. That is kind of at the foundation of what's needed to bring the kind of transformations that have to occur for us to be a country that's really of, by, and for the people.
Yeah, just a few comments of things that you didn't mention here in your discussion or your reply of attacks on democracy. We know there's all kind of attacks on voting rights across the country, particularly in certain states. We've had folks on here from the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina, where it's really intense. So attacks on even the limited expression, very limited, of democracy. I mean, once in a while you get the vote, right, is underway. Of course, corporations and Supreme Court decisions, not just McCutcheon, the most latest Supreme Court decision, where corporations are not only people, but they get to spend their billions to even more control of the political system, which, by the way, is an indicator of a growing weakness. The fact that they feel they need to increase their control by opening up the money spigots to make sure that the politicians stay in their back pocket is an example of concern about on their part of the empire's control in its own home base here. And of course, as you pointed out, all these First Amendment rights infringements, which are clearly unconstitutional, but they seem to be multiplying here of late. And as we said last week, the U.S. Crowd control, protest control, which you refer to here, is really being discussed and developed right under our noses And police departments are being centralized, you know, under the control of these federal agencies, and being funded and being militarized, and are forming these front organizations, the police organizations, that refuse to open up and say what the hell they're doing, like in Boston, the NAMLEC and so forth. This is going on right under our noses, and the U.S. is funding and having its police strategies coordinated with global police strategies, you know, how both in the third world elites, you know, capitalist elites, how they can better control, you know, the Arab Spring and so forth. Well, they're all coordinating now. They're all exchanging ideas and methods, strategies, tactics on protest control. That's going on right under our noses here. That's certainly an infringement of democracy going on. Margaret.
Poor Margaret.
Poor Margaret
gets to go after you and I do these long, detailed answers. She has to come up with something new to say. So I'm always interested to see what Margaret finds.
Well, I think, you know, what I really wanted to boil it down to is a couple of simple concepts that you guys have been talking about. And one is that you can't have a democracy when you have such a degree of inequality, because those who have the money in that situation really have the power. And at the same time, those who don't have the money are scrounging to meet their basic needs for housing and food, and can't really take any sort of an active role or participate in democracy. So inequality is really one of the roots of our lack of democracy in this country, and so we have to address that, and that's why our project Working for Economic Democracy and this kind of growing global and now growing in the United States movement to democratize the economy, to build wealth in local communities, is really fundamental to our struggle. And then I think the other piece that you guys talked about is the attack on our rights. And I think in the United States, one big piece of this is just for people to understand that we do have rights, not just our civil rights for freedom of expression, but also fundamental human rights to health care and education and a job with a living wage, and these things, that these are our rights, and we have to fight for them and really stop these infringements upon them. You know, to really push back against any infringements, particularly on our civil rights, to protest. I think that we should be questioning in our communities, and I'm not seeing enough of this yet, of, you know, this militarization of our police, even in rural communities where they're, you know, stocking up on weapons and tanks, and this is outrageous, and it's not just outrageous because of its threat to our rights, it's outrageous for the amount of money that's being spent that should be spent on really uplifting our community. And so we need to see more organizing and more pushback and questioning of this militarization of our police, and working together in solidarity when we see somebody in our community who is being, who is under attack, who's being oppressed in whatever way. We really need to start working together to support those people, because it's really true that we will be the next ones if we don't stand together, to see that assault on any one of us is really assault on all of us. And so those are just the closing points that I have.
Can I just make one point, Jack?
We still have 5 minutes time. Go ahead.
Okay, you know, these again are symptoms of a state that's acting in fear. Just think about it. Occupy was about 350,000 people protesting, and look at the crackdown it faced. Look at how they coordinated with mayors and police chiefs and Homeland Security and the various intelligence agencies to crack down and stop it. 350,000 people created such fear because the elites know they are acting criminally. They're acting illegally, that they're stealing from all of us. They know that people are starting to get wise to it. And if people see protests happening, they will grow incredibly. And so, to me, this is, again, an example of a state that's in fear of its people. And what we have to do is understand that we have more power than they want us to think we have. We have much more power. We can have an impact. We can make change. And we can delegitimize the government. Just by getting the truth out, and we get the truth out by joining together and showing that truth.
And at some point, we have to do so collectively. In other words, we have to get off the single issue stuff and realize that it's all the same problem. It's all the same challenge. You know, it's all the same attack on average folks here, and we have to unify in our opposition. You know, at some point, people are going to have to realize that all the single issues have to come together in some sort of national convention and form some sort of umbrella organization and begin some sort of better coordination and assistance rather than just pursuing their own single issue.
Well, that's what we're trying to do with PopularResistance.org.
Right, right. Again, that's PopularResistance.org, right? And also RollingRebellion.org.
Yep.
As references.
Right. I think the Rolling Rebellion is particularly important. Just initially, we're starting out with visibility actions to help people to understand that we don't live in a democracy. But ultimately, what is going to need to happen is that people come together in their communities and start talking to each other about the problems that we're facing and how they can really organize effectively to work together to overcome these problems, and that we can really build this kind of grassroots, ground-up participatory democratic process that's very empowering and will actually allow us to build an alternative system to overcome the current system that is causing so much harm.
And Margaret mentioned we have an economic project where we quote you all the time, Jack, and we publish most of your articles. It's called itsoureconomy.us, and that's our economic democracy.
Okay, another source. It's our economy.
All of these are linked to on the PopularResistance.org website, as well as people can get information about how to get involved. There's an upcoming conference being planned in New York around the People's Climate March in the days before it, so that we can come together and start converging our various movements and designating steps forward on how best to do that.
Yeah, well, just let me add my last 2 cents on this. What we're talking about is an organizational question, which I think is on the top of the agenda here today. And by the way, I'll be writing on that topic, what kind of grassroots organizational ongoing structure is necessary, both to revive the trade union movement, which I have a number of connections over the years, but also the local community, trade unionists and community. What kind of a new organization locally, of course, it's got to start there, is necessary to form a real resistance to what's going on. But I'll be writing about that as I am. Listeners might be interested in reading. I'm now writing a weekly column for Telesur, which is the media outlet for South America, countries resisting the empire from South America, Venezuela and others, Cuba, Argentina. So I will be providing an analysis of local organization requirements for moving the resistance to a higher level here in future weeks. Okay, so our show is over for today. Thank you so much, both of you, for your great insight. And again, listeners, PopularResistance.org, RollingRebellion.org. Make sure you go there. And also next week, we're going to look at the U.S. economy, the first preliminary numbers for second quarter GDP. Is this the road to recession? Is this more of stagnation, stop-go? Or is this a recovery? Okay, as you know, I don't believe the latter. But we'll come back and look at those GDP numbers in relationship to the 3% drop in the first quarter. What's going on with the U.S. economy? By the way, watch out, I would add, for financial instability coming, particularly in the junk bond markets. There are signs that we have bubbles going that may bust very soon. Again, Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Back to the U.S. economy next week.